been studying in Acts chapter 14. We want to go back there again this morning. This is finishing up Paul's first missionary journey. And those of you who have got the study manuals, you'll have a map in the back in the appendix that shows the map that I've got on a board, one that's a little bit easier to read for you. But Paul and Barnabas are in the midst of their journey. We got down to verse 19 last week in chapter 14, and we want to start back there again today. But Paul and Barnabas have had some problems in Lystra. What happened, as a matter of view, what happened to them in Lystra? Remember, they went there, and they were the people accused them of being Zeus and Hermes, and then the priest of that of those pagan religions started to do what? Remember? Yeah. Everybody's quiet this morning. I must be losing my touch on teaching, because nobody seems to remember what we talked about last week. But the priest in that town, they thought they were the people because of what Paul and Barnabas did. They healed a person who had been lame from his birth, and so they called Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes, because Paul was the chief speaker, and they started to offer sacrifice to him. And Paul and Barnabas tore their clothes. That seems to be something that was common during that time of history, wouldn't it? Tearing your clothes when things got a little bit difficult. They tore their clothes and went and ran and told him, said, "What are you doing?" What was their argument? What was her argument to say don't be offering to us? We're just men like you are. Exactly, Alice. What are you doing? There's nothing special about us. We're just men. We don't need to be worshipped. We're not anything in particular that ought to be worshipped. And Luke says that with their with all the things that they did in verse 18, and with these sayings scarce restrained they the people that they had not done sacrificing them. Everything that Paul and Barnabas could say, they just barely were able to stop them from doing sacrifices to them, because those people were convinced that they were Zeus and Hermes, Jupiter and Mercury. And they just knew that these men were the gods, the Roman gods, the Greek gods that they'd been worshiping, and so they wanted to worship them and offer sacrifices to them, and they barely stopped them from doing it. But interesting thing about it is human adulations and human respect doesn't last very long, does it? The very next verse, in verse 19. It starts off, and it says it, and there came certain Jews from Antioch and Iconium who persuaded the people, and having stoned Paul, drew him out of the city, thinking he was dead. So here they were, not just days before, trying to worship, trying to offer sacrifices to him, thinking he was Hermes or Mercury, the chief speaker of the gods, and now then they're stoning him and leaving him for dead. So that's the thing that it teaches us, is that human adulations aren't don't last, do they? Go ahead, Wilbert.
Well, there's two different groups of people, but the Jews who came to stone him later were not the ones who were calling them their old pagan gods.
But
it was the Gentiles that were
there. Yeah, but the thing about it is the pagan god didn't stop it.
Right,
they didn't stand up for him and stop it. And so here they were wanting to worship one time, and then allowed them to be stoned a few days later. And it says that these Jews came from Antioch and Iconium and persuaded the people, having stoned Paul and drew him out of the city, supposing he'd been dead. Now let's go take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter, I think it's chapter 11, starting about verse 21. How about somebody reading 2 Corinthians 11, 21 through 29 for me? Yes, sir.
To our shame, I say that we were too weak for that. But in whatever anyone is bold, I speak foolishly. I am bold also. Now, 21 to what?
29. Okay, thank you. So Paul here in the Corinthians talks about this. He simply says once he was stoned. He didn't say he was stoned and left for dead here in Corinthians. Acts, when Luke talks about this stoning, he said he was taken out and stoned and left for dead outside the city. Now this is one of the miracles that we often overlook. We don't often think about this as a miracle at all. But it is actually a miracle because Paul here stoned. He's stoned enough. Then these people, do you think that Paul is the first person they ever stoned? No, the Jews used stoning quite a bit. So they knew when somebody was dead, didn't they? They knew to stone them until they were completely dead. So Paul was stoned. He was dragged out of the city and left outside for dead. But listen what happens here in verse 20 of Acts chapter 14. He says, "Howbeit the disciples stood around about him, or as the disciples stood around about him, he rose up, came into the city, and the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe." Now, being stoned with thrown rocks at, the big rocks, enough that people think he's dead. And then he gets up, and the very next day, he walks. He starts walking to Derbe. Now, I don't know about you guys, but that's pretty remarkable feat to me, that he was able just the very next day to walk, to start doing that walking. And Lystra to Derbe is 30 miles. He had to walk 30 miles to Derbe. So that's quite a long time. 30 miles, a normal human walk is about 4 miles an hour. So we're talking about seven and a half hours of walking the very next day after being stoned and left for dead. So we see another miracle here that we often overlook and don't even think about it as a miracle. But Paul did. He was stoned and he was left for dead, and he got up the very next day and walked to Derbe. And he departed Barnabas to Derbe. And then verse 21, it says, "When they had preached the gospel in that city and taught many, they returned again to Lystra and to Iconium and Antioch." So Paul was, you know, What do we normally do when somebody treats us badly? Do we look forward to going back and meeting them again? No. What do we do, Hans?
No, they didn't look back. They looked forward. They returned to Iconium, even though the Jews from Iconium had stoned.
Yeah, they went straight back there. They went back to Lystra where they just got stoned. They went back to Iconium and Antioch, where the people that came from to Lystra to stone them were. They didn't avoid those people. Now, unfortunately, what we tend to do is avoid people that cause us trouble today. You know, in fact, I remember on our door knocking campaign, we had a couple people said, "Don't come back," and we marked our doors, and we don't plan to go back. But I wonder sometimes if we're not being too timid in our approach to the gospel. One of the things that don't get me wrong, I don't want to sound so crass here, but one of the things about salesmanship, I've read quite a bit about salesmanship, and one of the things that I've read is that most salesmen don't even ask for sale one time, but statistically, research shows that you have to ask for sale what time? 3 or 4 times? 5 times?
To get
a sale. But most people don't ask for sale once. And so I think a lot of times what we do is we go up to somebody, we're real timid about this, and, you know, we're for the Church of Christ, we'd like to talk to you about God. And they say, "Well, we don't want to have anything to do with that." And we kind of timidly walk off and don't ever come back. And I wonder if that's not being, is that's not being too timid in our evangelism. You know, are we treating them well, right, by doing that? Any thoughts on that? If you believe, you truly believe. So these are things we need to think of. Go ahead, Wilbert. In fact, I was thinking about this, looking back at our efforts. You know, we knocked on almost 400 doors, and we talked to several people, a lot of people, in fact. Thinking about this for next year, next fall when we start this again, hopefully, about how do we present ourselves? How do we get our material in such a way that people are encouraging people to be interested in this? Go ahead, Tom.
I think it's hit and miss on stuff. I'll just give you an example of my own situation with Allstate. I could call in a phone book right now. I'd have to call a lot of people because they'll know who I am. The call's coming out of the blue. But through many 400 or whatever, I could maybe get someone where I could grab. If I get a lead from an Allstate person who has met with the person who says, "By the way, I get the warm introduction," 10 times different. When you're just going to show up at someone's house, you can have whatever you want. It's really just a hit and miss. The best evangelistic tool is always going to be people who know other people in a relationship. So I think sometimes you can overthink a cold call on a door, but it ain't going to matter. Yeah. I think we had enough on some of our situations where there were some receptive people. And so to me, the numbers held true. You're going to have to knock on 50 doors to maybe have one person have somewhat of an interest. And if you get one person with somewhat of interest, you need 30 of them to have one show up.
Yeah.
That's just the reality. And that's why I think the whole point of the knocking of the door is the brochure and stuff. But that we're, you know, my line was, we're just down the street from you, drive by all the time. Come by and say hi sometime. You're just hoping you catch them at the right time. to people that we know and build relationships. Yeah. That's how it's going to go. I just don't see how you can have a door-knocking campaign where some extra brochure, extra line makes a huge difference. People are going to be interested or not. You went to one place for someone where someone was praying for someone to get them a church. Or, I mean, it was kind of one of those happen chance things that take place. But that's just my thoughts in 25 years of, you know, picking up a phone or talking to strangers versus someone that's a warm introduction. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, Wilbur.
And there's a study that was done a while back, too, that the result was they found that 80% of people who become Christians become Christians because they knew somebody who was Christian, like what Paul said, that it was that relationship, that connection.
Yeah.
The thing that, the way that I see what the Lord Hockey campaign does for us is an introduction. And we anchor in their mind, you know, like, we're the Church of Christ, where we at? We're here on Boulevard. Well, every time now they drive past that sign and they see our building, they're going to make that connection that, hey, these people show up at the office.
Yeah.
They invited me to come.
Yeah.
Later on in life, when they're a lead or something like that, and they say, hey, you know, I think I'd like to check this out further.
Yeah.
The contact is getting there.
Yeah.
The seed has been planted.
Yeah.
But just like you see in the scriptures here, 80% of the people who become a Christian become a Christian because they know you were a Christian and they were invited to come.
Yeah. I think another thing, too, that we often overlook is those evangelistic campaigns. There's a secondary advantage to that, and that's on us. The people are going out. I think it makes our faith a little bit stronger when we do that. And, you know, like Tom said, I did run across a woman who said she'd been praying that morning for somebody for a church to go to. I haven't seen her here yet. But, you know, hopefully she'll read the brochure and decide to come. And we'll see what happens. I know Hans and I had people that told us that they really didn't want us to come back around. And I know other people that had that experience. But I think the thing to do is, the thing to keep in mind is that as we went, and the thing to keep in mind is we see from Paul's experience here that he wasn't shy about going back to those people who actually had stoned him and left him for dead. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I was going to say that one part that I got from the whole thing was just the camaraderie as well. As, you know, talking to Ben about that, it was fun. I mean, it was you're a little bit nervous about the whole situation, things maybe you hadn't done before, but getting together, making our powwow, and we go out. I one time ran into Ben, and we finished up together, ran into you, and then we come back to the building, just kind of just talk about it. But 90% of the time was pretty much successful. Most of the time, people didn't have an issue. But one of the grandest things, when I took my granddaughter,
yep.
Bill, she didn't have a name badge thingy, and so Bill made her one. And I had her hand out the brochures, and she even asked about it again to me because she thought it was kind of neat. But it kind of taught her something about just Christianity and trying to share something to someone. So I think when you build upon ourselves and what we're doing, God will grant whatever He needs to grant for us. But it's our faith in that, even something that seems to be kind of a more difficult way to spread the word, but the camaraderie behind all of it certainly seemed to be something that was worth the time and effort in by itself.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I think that's one of the important things to do. And I think Paul and Barnabas, they had been friends before. You know, Barnabas was one of the first people that encouraged the church to Paul to become active in the church. Barnabas went to Damascus and searched out or Tarsus and searched out Paul. Remember when he was still called Saul of Tarsus, and that bond became strong. It was later tested because of John Mark. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into that here in the next missionary journey. But that bond was made strong. It was a strong bond for life, and I think that's an important thing. But the thing that I think that we need to keep in mind here is that Paul, even though he was stoned, he went right back to that town where he was stoned and left for dead. And then he went right back to those cities where those people, the Jews, had come from who had him stoned and left for dead. And I think that's a lesson for us all. Go ahead, Kenny.
Well, he says in I think 14:22, he says that we must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. So, you know, if you go back to the Great Commission, Jesus commanded us He also says that we're to obey the laws of the land, but unless they interfere with the laws of God. And when God says go knock on people's doors, it doesn't matter if there's a no soliciting sign and the government says this, that, we can disobey that, what the government says, because what God says trumps that.
Yeah. And I think another thing to keep in mind, too, is when they went back, what did they do in those towns? Were they evangelizing or exhorting?
They were exhorting.
They were exhorting when they went back to those towns. They went back to the disciples in those towns, confirming the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in the faith that we must through much tribulation, is what Kenny said, enter the kingdom of God. So when they went back to Derby, it wasn't so much to evangelize, but it was to get with those people that they had already converted and encourage them, exhort them. So that was a reason for going back to Derbe and Antioch and Poseida, or Lystra, on their way back to Antioch where they started from. So they're going back now, and they're exhorting the Christians that they had made, and they're telling them that we must through much tribulation enter the kingdom of God. Now, when Jesus was talking earlier, remember he tells us that we're going to be able to have 100 times in this life what we give up. Jesus and Peter were talking, and Jesus said there's going to be sacrifice. And Jesus, and Peter says, look at what we've already done for you. We left our business, we left our homes, we followed you through this thing. And Jesus says, yeah, you know, you're going to get 100 times more in this life and in the life to come, eternal life, with persecutions. Jesus promised that we're going to be persecuted. This life is not going to be easy, this Christian life. It's not going to be easy. And Satan, the thing about Satan is he's not divine, and he doesn't have the ability to see into the future. What he was doing then was trying to stomp the church out through persecutions. Has he done that in the United States lately? Tried to stomp the church out through persecutions? And never stopped. But what else has he been doing, Alice? He's trying to stomp the church out by letting us have such an easy life that things are so easy that we think everything's going just well. I think he's trying. Pardon?
Having an easy
life is not necessarily a bad thing.
Sorry.
It's bad. It's just like the. It's just like money. Is having money a bad thing? Mm-hmm. What's the problem with money? When we start loving it rather than loving God, that's the problem with money. It's not that a rich man can't go to heaven. Jesus says it's just hard for him to go to heaven because he starts making his money into his God. And so here we have Satan persecuting, and today we don't, here at least in the United States, we don't see that overt persecution like you do in other parts of the world today. But what we have is Satan being smart enough to say, well, we'll make life real easy for them, and then they'll decide they don't need God. You know, and that's something I think is a real risk for us today is forgetting that we need God because things are going so well for us. And go ahead, Hans.
I'm sure in Paul's day, there was a lot of uncertainty and, you know, travel, the modes of travel especially. Paul was shipwrecked 3 times out of probably 8 or 9 voyages, and very unreliable. I wouldn't be stepping on a ship if Paul was shipwrecked once or twice, but Paul was shipwrecked 3 times.
Yeah.
I think a Kirby vacuum salesman would be an ideal Christian because, you know, like Paul, he was persistent.
All right.
Wouldn't take no for an answer.
Right. And I think that's one of the advantages that I got out of door knocking. Of course, this wasn't my first time at door knocking. I door knocked when I was real young, but it's been a while. But one of the things I think that I got out of it was that ability to get past the fear about going up to somebody's door you never even knew and talk to them about Jesus. And I think that's one thing that happened. Did I ever completely get over that? No. Every time I went to a door, I wondered what kind of reception I was going to get. I was concerned about it, but still knocked on the door. Go ahead, Wilbur. Yeah, he did.
He went to those who were the Jewish believers, things like that. And it would be similar to us going to the church and teaching them the true gospel, just like the Jews needed to hear the fulfillment of the law. The denominational people need to hear the true gospel.
Right.
And leave the doctrines of sin behind and things like that. And that was one of the things that the Reformation movement was built around, Alexander Campbell and Thomas Campbell. Mm-hmm.
Raymond?
Remember that, bro.
Yeah.
The trap I think the church has fallen in today is this. The clergy laity mindset. When we talk about going around and evangelizing, that's all well and good. But the mindset, the pervasive mindset seems to be, well, let's leave it to the experts. Let's leave it to those in leadership positions. Let's do this or that. No, it's on us.
Yeah.
Each and every person, it's on us to do it.
Exactly. That's a good point. I think
that, you know, unfortunately, this milk, toast, and honey mindset as well combines into that.
Yeah.
You know, and so we end up coming off as these poor little people who can't do this or that.
Yeah.
No. Christ said, I did not come to bring peace. I came to bring a sword. You're going to have separation.
Right.
You're going to have conflict. Guaranteed. You're going to have mother-in-law against daughter-in-law. So forth and so on. And so it's going to happen. And if the continuing mindset of, well, just do what we can, do this and do that, and drag as many people into Canada, it's not going to work.
And I think that's a good point, Raymond, that you've got. And one of the things, whenever I was talked about coming up here to work with the church here, is I told Ed and Hans that you have enough preachers here. I mean, Hans is a good preacher. Philip is coming up, stepping forward. Tom's good. Charles is good. Joe's good. Eddie's good. Eric is preaching. There are plenty of preachers here. I don't need to preach all the time. You know, in fact, I think it's sometimes contraindicated for me to preach all the time when there's other people who can do it, because by them preaching, it causes them to study. How much time do you spend getting a lesson up, guys? I mean, it's not so. I know that I'm kind of an advantage because I was preaching 12 years outside, so I've got 12 years of sermons I can go back on if I have to. But it takes a while to do that, and while you're doing that, you're studying, and I think that's a good, to me, that's a good thing, and not let it on the person. My job is not to do the preaching, but my job is to try to encourage us to evangelize and try to coordinate those efforts, try to get everybody out doing that, not just a few people that are preaching, or not just a few people that Hans and Ed are the elders. You know, it's easy for sit back and say, well, let the elders do that, but that's not what they need to be doing. And we need to be out, every one of us need to be out evangelizing and spreading the gospel. Kenny? Tom?
Yeah, I was thinking to Raymond's point to continue on. You know, when we had our little preachers conference deal just recently that we're part of, Bill, in Ephesians chapter 4, that talked about the unity of the Spirit, but there was a point where he got into verse 11 saying, and he gave some as apostles and some as prophets, evangelists, some as pastors and teachers. So some people might be more equipped for a preaching role, an eldership role, or whatever. However, the whole point of that part of those groups is in verse 12, for the equipping of the saints for the work of the service, the building up of the body of Christ. And so it isn't up just to Bill, who says, I'm going to work with their women and evangelize. Bill's role for us is to teach us in a way and to assist us in a way that we will equip each and every one of us the abilities to the encouragement of one another, to building up of the church, to go out and have the confidence to talk to people, to know what to say and when objections come, and to be a lighthouse, to be all of that. And so the objective then for any leadership role is for those that to be, for others to eventually get to that position as well.
Yeah.
So it is. It's, we all got to work together and all do a little piece of everything.
And Paul equates the church to a body, doesn't he? He says, if everybody were an eye, where would the foot be? Or if everybody were a foot, where would the hand be? And he tells us that we need everybody in order to make the congregation work as efficiently as it should. Wilbert? Right.
And if we could have that mindset that when I'm at work, I'm still a Christian and I'm an evangelist.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever I am, this is my job. And Bill Clary at South Anglican gave it up, I still remember it years ago. But about what is your profession? Your profession is not a school teacher, a carpenter, auto mechanic, a special officer, myself. My profession is Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I take that with me everywhere I go. That's in my forethought. And if that's in my mind every minute of every day, regardless of the tasks that I'm doing at the time.
I think that's a good point. I think that's a real good point. I remember back whenever I was working, I had several situations where I was expected to attend certain functions. And each one of those functions was always alcohol there. But everybody knew that I didn't drink. So what they'd do is bring a six-pack of Pepsis for me, so that I could have Pepsis, you know, and they didn't ask me to drink. They didn't force me to kid me about not drinking or anything. They knew that I was a Christian and I wasn't going to drink. And so they made arrangements for that. And as soon as possible that I could get out without being rude, I'd leave. But people knew that I was a Christian and that I wasn't going to drink. And so they didn't try to make me drink. I think you're right. I think we need to be a Christian first, and in whatever else we are, that's what we do. But our Christianity is the overriding thing of who we are. That's what Paul was. He was a Christian first. And he goes on to say, and we're going to finish this up now. He said, when they had preached the word in they commended the Lord. Let's go back to verse 23. And when they had ordained them elders in every church and prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord and on whom they believed. Now I want to spend a little bit of time with that. And unfortunately, we spent so much time talking about evangelism, but it left us not much time to talk about this. How long was it between the time that they started this journey and they came back appointing elders? How long did it take? Not very long. It didn't take them 5 or 10 years to go back and get elders. And so one of the things I hear today about people who are in churches where we need elders, well, I haven't been a Christian long enough. And certainly there is the requirement of not being a novice in Paul's letter to Timothy and Titus about the qualification for elders. We don't need to be appointing novices, brand new Christians. But it wasn't, they didn't have to take years to get, 15, 20 years to become qualified to be elders. And they went back and appointed elders in every city. And I think that's the thing to do. God's church works best the way he designed it. And how did he design it? With a men's business group to run the church? No, he designed it with elders to run the church. And I think that's one of the things that we really need in the church today is strong elders. Go ahead.
We're still at the time, though, when the apostles came to you at power laying on hands and passed gifts on faith, is one of the gifts that was mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. So I tend to think that when they came through there, the men who were appointed as elders over the Lord's church in such a short time and were appointed by the apostles, may have had the assistance. And I
don't doubt that at all. But what I'm trying to say is that having elders is so important that they appointed elders went on the way back through. And sometimes we don't do that. I mean, I know a church in the town where my mother went to church at, and there was a doctor in that town who said he would never worship at a church with elders. And consequently, that church doesn't have elders because he's a principal contributor to the church and stuff. He's anti-elder. And when you get right down to the bottom of it, he's anti-elder because he was disfellowshipped because of errors in his teaching at one time. And that's wrong. The church needs elders. That's how God designed it. That's how it works best. And that's the way we need to have it today. We're going to finish up real quickly. They left in verse 27, it says, when they were come, they had gathered to church together. This is back in Antioch from where they started from. And they rehearsed all that God had done with them and had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. And there they abode a long time with the disciples. So they went on their journey, they got back, and they're with the disciples in Antioch. And we're going to pick it up next Sunday morning in chapter 15. And 15 is not about going right back on our second journey, but there's some problems in church that we're going to deal with next Sunday morning. Thanks a lot for your attention and your comments.